history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories that need to be told. There are men and women around us who have done extraordinary things for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, and in that process, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that'll be the case today in Madera, California, home for the last 28 years for Pascual Reyes, or as his wife Ramona and friends call him, Pesco. I thought that was a pasta sauce or something, huh?
No.
Or somebody who likes fish.
No.
How long have they been calling you Pesco?
Since a long time, way back when I was young.
And you're the oldest of six children growing up in Los Angeles before World War II. Something tells me L.A. was a little different back then. What do you remember about your childhood in Southern California?
I had my grandfather and grandmother. They were still living, and my aunts and my uncles. So I was very happy there in L.A. for a while. Until I wanted to move out of there and come up north. And her mother was here, living here in Madera, and her aunt and her other relative, and we came up here. I liked it. I liked it right away. And it had been a beautiful place to live, you know. At that time, it was nice and quiet, serene, very, very low profile of people around here. When we moved here, you only had a few houses.
Well, and I think anybody who drives down your block probably notices something about your house. I think your flag flies higher than anybody else on the block. Why do you have that Stars and Stripes flying so high out front?
Remind everybody that I'm a veteran, and we fought for my country. And I want the people to pass through. And they stare at it. They slow down and look at the flag to know that we have the freedom in this country. A lot of people just take it for granted, and not me. I want to show the people that that flag that's flying, was fought for the freedom that we have today. And a lot of guys went out and gave their lives for that. And I wanted to be reminded and be reminded myself, but I want the people to know that.
You talk about that people have fought and died for our freedom. Now, you understand that from multiple perspectives. You've had to live without freedom as a prisoner of war. Your son was killed in action in Vietnam.
Yes.
I imagine few people understand the price of freedom better than you do.
Yes, because like I said, you know, freedom is not just given to you. You have to fight for it and live with it and let everybody know what freedom means, the freedom that you get. You fight for it, and you keep it in your country. Don't let up with our defenses all the time, because there's a lot of people in different countries that want to hurt our country. So that's why we keep our defenses up all the time.
And we're going to hear about your time as a prisoner of war and the things that happened before and after that. But I want to hear about your childhood, because I'm just trying to picture being a young boy in East L.A., late 20s through the 30s. Do you remember having some big ideas, some dreams and hopes and ambitions about what you were going to do when you grew up?
Well, at that time, I wanted to be a ranger, be on the outside. That's what I wanted to be. I actually, because I was in the CC camps, I was up there in the forest, up there in the mountains. And oh, I used to like that, you know, the smell of the trees and all that in the morning, you know. We had barracks like a regular army. Man, that was beautiful, being there, you know. And I wanted to be that. I wanted to be a ranger. But I had been in the CC camps, you know. And I said, I'm going to be a ranger. But it never happened, you know.
Well, some other things changed around the world that interrupted your plans there. But a lot of people don't know about the Civilian Conservation Corps and these camps where youngsters like you, teenagers, were out there working and saving money. And it probably prepared you for the military too, huh?
Oh, yes. We had a regular army captain that was a commander of the... He was retired, but he still dressed as a army captain. And he had command of the camp. He had people there show us how to use a coal or a pig for the fires. And he was very, very interested the way we fought the fires.
So you guys are fighting forest fires. Where was this? Was this around here somewhere or down south?
Around here. All these big mountains.
All through the Sierra Nevada. You guys were fighting fires and working on projects.
Yeah. But this time, this fire that broke out started going up in the trees, you know, from one tree to another. So some guys got hurt. So they took us off the firefighting and let the regular rangers do the fireman.
And how old were you when you were in the CC camps?
At that time, I was about 16, 17 years old. I was young guy, real young.
So not a long time before Pearl Harbor happened. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Well, it was up in the radios. We didn't have no TV then. It was just in the radios, and it was scary. We were young, but we still felt that, you know, we understood that our boats that were sunk and all that was very bad, real terrible.
So you're 18 years old when that happens. Yeah. You hear about this on the radio. Did you think that you were going to be involved in this somehow?
Well, I didn't. It never hit my head. But then, you know, when they started in Germany, and I figured out by the years, I said, I think I'm going to be going for sure, you know. And I sure did, because in time, they drafted me. I went into the L.A. We got sworn in. I had a wife already, you know. I never got to see my kid get born. When I left, my wife left me, you know.
So when you went overseas, she was pregnant?
Yeah.
And your first child was born while you were gone.
Yeah.
But by the time you came back, she had moved on.
She had moved on. I never blamed her. Of course, you know, she was young and I was young, you know. So I knew she wasn't going to be waiting for me, you know.
So was it easy to adjust to life in the Army early on, or was that kind of a shock to your system?
Well, when I got into the Army, I was very curious about what would come next, you know. So it didn't bother me that much. You know, I used to that, especially the clunkers they gave me for shoes. You know, I would get blisters and all that, like everybody. I finally got adjusted. And in fact, I liked it a lot, you know. I used to like to march, adjusted one way or another, running and exercise. I like to exercise. I felt myself gaining a little more weight and being more stronger, more alert for everything. I liked it. I really got adjusted to the Army. I don't know how, but I really got adjusted.
And you ended up in the 36th Infantry Division.
Oh, yes.
What was that like? What were the other guys like, and how did they treat you?
At first, you know, we were like strangers to each other, because all of them that were from different, you know, environment, whatever. They were from the same place. Some of these guys came from being neighbors and all that. They're in Texas. But after that, you know, they got adjusted. I had a good sergeant, a Mexican sergeant. I liked him a lot, you know, and he was a very understanding person. Any problems I had, I would go to him, and he would fix it or do something for it. And, you know, I didn't see my kid, like I said, but I told him if they could send a message to my kid, and they did. It was okay. I took orders, and I enjoyed those, you know.
And you ended up in a rifle platoon or what?
Rifle platoon. I was in the 3rd squad. I enjoy it. I like, you know, marching around and all that. And I knew I had my rifle and my bayonet, my canteen, my belt, heavy belt that I have more ammunition, more clips, you know.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas and fighting this enemy and risking your life? Were you nervous about that? Were you unsure of what it was going to be?
It still didn't hit my head that much, you know. But I know that I was going to be in danger. That, you know, you see your rifle and ammunition, and you hear, you know, you're going to go fight the enemy. And I figured, well, hell, you know, we're going to have rifles and ammunition. There's something else. This is not cops and robbers. No, man, when I got over there and we made the invasion, I had those bandoliers like Pancho Villa, you know. When we got off the invasion, I had to take those things. I was smart. I took those things off. We were still had to walk all the way up to the beach. So I took those things off, I left enough ammunition in my belt because some of the guys got drowned.
Yeah, it's heavy. That could weigh you down. So, and the invasion you're talking about is North Africa?
Yeah.
What did you see and experience when you came ashore?
Well, I didn't do a heavy fighting there. Like I say, we just waded to the ground.
Waded through some shallow water onto the beach with no opposition at that point.
They did that just for us to get a sense of it. But in Italy, we did get off. Oh, that was hard. I mean, you see the guys not being knocked off, you know, by the machine guns. Those Germans put those crossfire, a lot of crossfire, a lot of bunkers. But, you know, our ships were knocking those bunkers. You should see, you know, they were shooting the destroyers. They came close, and you could see the bunkers just fly up in the air. A lot of Germans in there. Well, they held us there in the beachhead for I don't know how long. There were a lot of guys being knocked off. So the sergeant said, we have to get off the beach, you know. They're knocking us, a lot of us. If we're going to have to die, we might as well die getting those bunkers and breaking them through. So we did. We got in between the bunkers and got it up in the back and threw grenades into the bunker. And a lot of Germans started coming out. A lot of Germans died. But all the line moved up. Like I said, some of the guys got knocked off. But we took all the bunkers and chased those Germans to Kane. And then we got up there. By that time, the paratroopers had landed in the back. We met with the paratroopers. We did pretty good that the other day. I think we marched about 15 miles inland and met with the paratroopers. We did a lot of fighting. All the way fighting. House fighting, street fighting, you name it. We did it.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of close calls contained in all of that. But before I move on from North Africa, there aren't too many people alive anymore who fought in North Africa.
Oh, no.
I mean, that was the earliest action that America had in that part of the war. What was that like? What was the fighting in North Africa like?
It was kind of hard because you fight in those sand dunes and all that, you know. You're going straight in the ground, and sometimes you would go down, and you would never think there's a hole there. And then the mines. How the heck are you going to see a mine? Until they came around with that thing, you know, and you would be stopped, and you would be a target. You know, those Germans were very smart the way they planned it. Those mines, plus they had those defense lines, but we got into it, you know. They had us right in the open. They had tanks right across, a lot of tanks, and they could shoot, knock the heck out of us.
Well, that brings up a lot of questions in my mind. When you talk about these minefields and either you're risking it by going through them and not knowing when one's going to go off,
right,
or you know they're out there so you can't move and then you're a sitting duck for them to shoot you. So did you experience witnessing or hearing other guys being blown up by mines?
We seen them. I seen them with my own eyes. You fight like that, what you do, you go behind the tank so you can be protected by smoke and fire or whatever it is. He's going to hit the tank first. So you have to get behind the tank. And you could see some of the guys would go around it, hit a mine. He would be blown up. You know, and when you see a human being blown up, it's very, very terrible. We never say nothing about that, but I'm saying that right now. You see the bloods and guts, and because they had two kinds of mine, one in the ground and the other one that jumping ready, what they call it. It comes up to a certain height, then it'll explode. So, you know, you can imagine what was left of a human being, of a soldier, nothing, just a bunch of blood and skin.
And you're just a young kid. You're half a world away from your family, and then you're seeing stuff like this.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that make you feel? Do you think you're going to be next?
No, I never thought about that. What I did was get more experience and take care of myself the way I walk in different places and be sure that the moment anything happened, to go flat on my stomach. You know, some of the guys didn't know, what are you doing that for? But for me, I knew what I was doing, exactly what I was doing. You know, that way I took care of myself. That's the way I fought all the way up in Africa.
Do you remember the first time you had to deal with losing someone you had gotten to know?
Yes. In that part of Africa, we lost a guy. You know, and it was only a replacement. We were in a regular division yet. But then when they put us in a regular division, of course, you know, I seen a lot of guys We were in the invasion, you know. You get off those flatboats, you know, and start running towards the beachhead. Those Germans got all those crossfire machine guns, like I say, you know. And then they put those mines in high water, in high tide. And some of the guys, you know, would step on them. A lot of them. A lot of guys were hung up on the wires and all that. But I didn't have time to keep looking back, you know, or trying to help a friend of mine. They could call out, but they were, you know, they were all dead. You could see, you know, their bodies all open.
How do you keep going in circumstances like that? How did you deal with what was happening around you and the death and destruction and tragedy and not just go crazy?
Well, in the first place, you ask God to help you. Little Lord, help me to go with all this, you know. I don't want, you know, I lost just friends, and just keep me going, keep me free from being hurt. And I kept on going. I had faith. And guys, you know, don't believe in that. Someone else says, what the hell are you doing? You know, I knew what I was doing. And I did that all the way, you know, even when I got captured. But it never stopped me from doing my duty, what I was there for. If I had to shoot a German, I would do it. But I didn't freeze or, you know, some guys will freeze. I'll tell you, they'll freeze and they get sick after they see all that around them. But not me. I got a really cold. I had like a chip on my shoulder, anger, because I seen all my friends, some of them get killed. I got like a revenge or a chip on my shoulder. I want to do the same thing to them. And that's what kept me going.
And he kept going and going and going with the 36th Infantry Division, North Africa, Italy, on into France, and then into captivity. It's a pretty amazing story this former prisoner of war can tell. Time for our first break. But don't forget to go over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video relating to Mr. Reyes and his story. And we'll be right back after this.